Welcome to Watershed Chats, presented by the Water People Podcast in collaboration with Patagonia. Watershed moments are traditionally understood as a division or distinction between two phases. They can be turning points that define our shared history. Here, we sit down with experts and those having a go at building and dreaming new ways into fruition for a healthy and habitable future on planet Ocean. Damon Gameau is an actor and filmmaker. He directed That Sugar Film, an expose on the personal and political impacts of consuming refined sugars, which became the highest-grossing Australian documentary of all time. More recently, he wrote and directed 2040, a feature documentary that explores what the future would look like by the year 2040 if we embraced the best solutions already available to us to alleviate climate change. As we're recording amidst social distancing, Dave and Damon caught up over the net, so please excuse any dropouts or glitchy moments, and enjoy hearing from one of Australia's leading documentary filmmakers.
It is a very interesting time for us that a lot of friends of mine in the sort of climate environment space, as I'm sure you're finding, have said that a lot of momentum has ground to a halt. There was certainly some serious traction post-bushfires, and we certainly found even with the film that the screening events just sort of really shot up quite exponentially after the fires, and from really unlikely partners too. So energy companies or all the banks, AFL clubs, everyone was starting to do screenings and discuss the climate and what they could do within their own organisation. So a lot of that has just completely stopped, understandably and rightly so. But I guess it will be interesting to see what happens as we re-emerge again from our little cocoon and see what shape we take and how much we prioritise that. I'd like to think that we have learnt a big lesson about ignoring science in this particular episode, that science and data is still very important and should take precedent over politics and other matters. And we've seen the countries that have handled this crisis the best. They've done it with clear messaging. They've used data. They've had organisations that have stepped almost ahead of the politicians and created the decisions and the solutions from that space. And I hope that even within our own country, we take a lesson from that in terms of how important science still is in informing decisions that are going to protect us and save lives. So in that sense, there's still a lot going on. We've sort of probably pivoted a little bit. There's still people doing online virtual screenings and still doing quite a lot of talks. But it's more about the sort of, I guess 2040 had that ecological element to it, but it was also about caring and about community and strengthening community. So we still feel that we can share positive stories about that because there are just extraordinary things going on around the world in terms of the altruistic elements of people that are coming out as we put a pause on the competitive capitalist game that we play. As soon as we sort of stop having to conform to that particular form of behaviour, it's really interesting to see what's emerging. So, I feel very much that the work still will be done. I mean, as you said, there's so many projects off the back of the film, like the Seaweed Project and Carbonate, that are still going and still we're absolutely pushing and will continue to push, really. So I feel that this is going to be my work probably for the rest of my life in some capacity. I'll be making other things, but as you know, this is too big an issue. You can't just sort of explore it for a while then flick it away and move on to something else. I certainly can't. You know, if we don't get this one right, then it affects every other topic. So, I'm still deeply committed despite everything that's going on.
Yeah. I'm curious about pre-Sugar Film and 2040, just about your journey from probably being a typical 20-year-old bloke in Australia just having a good time and, you know, we're pretty good at sticking our head in the sand when we're 20-year-old dudes in such a blessed country like this.
Sticking your head in all sorts of areas, yeah.
So how did you elevate yourself and come out of that period in time and develop the type of critical thinking that you have now? I'm really curious about that sort of change over period, if there was a trauma moment or like an experience in particular, or if it was a broader period of time that delivered you from that place to this place now.
Yeah, I mean, I was certainly I feel that a lot of my friends now wouldn't kind of recognise even me in my mid-20s. Like I was I had an interesting upbringing that was, not dissimilar to a lot of other people's that, you know, was okay in some ways, but then also fraught with sort of traumatic elements that sort of shaped me and made me download certain programs of operating and the way I spoke to myself and the desperate seeking of validation and affirmations. And so that, I guess, brought out a part of me that certainly chased an industry like acting and wanting that validation and wanting to be liked and lauded and looked after. It was a very sort of vanity-driven career move. And I very much cultivated this image of a sort of velvet jacket wearing, rolly smoking, red wine drinking Lothario that couldn't get past 3 months in a relationship. Like once that honeymoon was over, like next, I was done. And I don't look back at that time with any sort of pride. I mean, it was a learning period, but I sort of cringe a bit at the thought of that person. But I always had this sense that something wasn't right. Like even when I was doing these acting jobs, every now and again you'd do one which really I felt had meaning or significance, but very rarely does that happen in that particular industry. And I'd be on set thinking, what am I doing? Like this is just something's, I'm not telling my own stories, I'm telling other people's stories, which is easy to do when you're an actor. You're not creating anything yourself to a degree. You're saying other people's lines and views and values, and you're sharing those with a wide population. So if they don't completely align with your own values, that can be quite grating sometimes. And then I chased this girl to London and in a relationship, and I remember we had a pretty tumultuous breakup, and I was sort of sitting on the steps of this nightclub after watching her patch another guy in front of me, and you know, classic story.
Oh,
and just like
tragedy.
Feeling the depths of the universal pain, and like so sort of self-deprecating and full of lots of actor kind of self-indulgent on the steps of London. And I just got home. I was like, this is not it. Like, come on, dude, you're 31. This is not it. Something's not right here. Like, you've got to actually work out what it is that's holding you back, that's limiting. You're not doing the things you want to do. Where's your courage? Step up. So I just started this journey of sort of self-exploration of a variety of ways. It began with a couple of classic books and cliched books, and then I did a couple of courses, and then I drank from the well of the ayahuasca in the Amazon. Like, I just did the whole gamut of spiritual quest, and just started to unlock.
Before we go any further there, I'm really curious, why did you choose that route and say not like going to university or doing going to an institution and you know?
Well, I've sort of done that. When I finished school, I thought I wanted to be a journalist, and I started doing a journalism. Well, I started doing a law degree and then journalism. And I just, after, I don't know, probably about 8 weeks, I just thought, this isn't for me. I'm not ready to do this yet. I wasn't mature enough. I hadn't sort of landed properly. So, and then when I did go to drama school, I went to NIDA for 3 years, which was sort of an institution in a way. You're sort of in there every day and they try and strip you down and build you back up. And so I felt like I'd done that, and I just actually needed to live. I felt like I needed to get out and experience different cultures and life and just sort of just go on that classic sort of mid-20s, late-20s journey of discovery that you do. And I just started sort of unlocking things and realising just the way I'd been behaving was very self-limiting and destructive in a lot of ways, and I'd inherited certain programs, and just the way I was treating myself and treating women, all sorts of things, just wasn't it. So right in, as I started that, I met Zoe, my wife, who I just couldn't believe a human could have such radiance and grace and presence. And I just was like, wow, but I'm not ready for her. Like, I am still smoking Marlboro Lights and taking ecstasy every Saturday night. I am not in her vibrational frequency. No. I've got to do some things if I'm going to reach that benchmark. So that was a big impetus for me to keep diving even deeper and try and unlock who I really was and drop all the bullshit. And then I remember I got really sick and I was in hospital for about a week, and they were short on hospital beds. And so I stayed in this ward with these three sort of octogenarians, and it was really interesting. I mean, it was very funny, like the conversations we had. We're all sitting in bed, sharing the delightful hospital food. I would, you know, some of them had night terrors. I'd have to get up and put my hand on their shoulder. It was a really, really beautiful kind of, it would make a great sitcom. And I wrote myself this letter one night. I couldn't sleep and it's 2 a.m. and I just sat up in bed and got the pen out and I just wrote this letter pretending that I was 85 in that bed. And I thought, okay, if you're 85 and you're sitting here, have you done the things you wanted to do? Did you take the risks? Did you jump off the cliff? Did you say the things you actually wanted to say about the world and what you think of it? Or did you just always hide behind this self-limiting, self-doubting thoughts, the ease of the acting industry? How would you feel about that if you had done that and you were sitting here? And it, just one of those lovely moments that I just leapt into the future and had a conversation with myself, and the future me was like, get on with it, dude. Like, get on with it. Stop. You know, you've procrastinated enough. Stop hiding. Have the courage to actually say what you want to say. This is your one moment in all the history of space and time. You have been given this precious moment. Can you bloody do something with it?
Mm.
And so a couple of days later, Zoe wanted to do this kind of weird detox, kind of bentonite clay stuff, 3 days, no eating. I was really in love at the time, so I was just literally doing anything she said. And I said, look, if we're going to do that, I've written this really like daggy song for kids about animals. It was like this thing called Animal Beatbox. And it was like dogs and cats and dogs and cats and dogs and cats. And I said, let's just make a video for that. So we made the video, and it was like just stop motion with a camera, built this set at my mum's house. It cost $80. And then Zoe said, you've got to enter that to trot this. I was like, I'm not entering that, because that went against everything that I'd cultivated in terms of the velvet jacket, rolly smoking cool guy. This was a very daggy piece about being helping the planet. So it was so fucking confronting. And I thought, okay, I'll enter it. And then it got in, and I was like, oh, shit, now I'm going to have to sit and watch it with 500,000 people around Australia. They're going to see a part of me that I've been hiding for 28 years or whatever. And then it fucking won. So it was like, oh, my God. So I just suddenly was kind of kicked into my own the truth of who I am and all the things I'd feared. I mean, the next day, anyone who's experienced TropFest knows that it's just open slather for just to – it's the classic tall poppy, you know, thing in Australia, that anyone that wins TropFest, just the next day, it's just a bloodbath. And so, of course, you know, everything came at me from, you know, I stole the idea till how can this shitty $80 film win? But I realised that in the moment, if you watched it after the event, you go, oh, yeah, fair enough, that seems really simple. But on the night, people had a few red wines. There was a lot of films about, like, heavier topics, cancer and whatnot, and my film just came on, and it was just this little ball of joy for a moment. And I felt everyone come out of that and get into their hearts, and this childlike roar just kind of went around TropFest. And I'll just, that's the moment for me that I thought, wow, this is to bring joy to people, even momentarily, is what I want to do for the rest of my life creatively. Like just to pull them out of that reverie just for a moment and remind them of that essence that's inside them. And so all the backlash that came the next few days, you know, I went through my own necessary shadows and pains. Well, you know, it's no big deal. But for me, it was quite confronting because it's what I've been scared of. And suddenly I felt quite liberated to make things and go, right, well, obviously they connect. Something worked about that. Keep making stuff. And then it all went from there. I was doing a film in India as an actor, this cricket film, and then the producers of that were a company called Madman, who's a big distributor in Australia, and they said, look, do you want to make a film? And I just went, yeah, I do. Like, let's go. And I just loved the idea of sugar and the aesthetic and the Willy Wonka madness that you could bring to a film about that. And it was very topical at the time. There was lots of debate. And I just went from there and really learnt on the fly. And that was another thing that I'd probably say, that I had all these barriers about needing to be an expert and needing to know my craft intimately before I could make anything. Whereas reality, I did jump off the cliff, got the right people around me, which is the key, that know their stuff and were really supportive, and then just set an intention for what I wanted it to be. And then all the magic starts to happen. And, you know, I remember having a moment, we had Hugh Jackman and Stephen Fry in it. And I remember the cameraman saying, he was telling me about, asking me about lenses for Stephen Fry's shot. I said, I don't know. Like, I didn't know anything about lenses. And he's like, how can you be filming Stephen Fry and not know about a lens? And I thought, well, that's why you're here, because I value your skills and you're teaching me. And so I often say that to young directors or people that are scared to make that first thing, is that you don't have to know it all. And all you have to do is have a very strong intention, be open to collaboration and sharing, have an open heart and be good at problem solving as you go along, and just enjoy the madness of the journey and have fun with it. And that will translate onto the screen, and then the audience will watch that, and the essence of that will infect them as they're viewing it.
Oh, man, so well put. And isn't it so amazing how much more receptive we are when we've got a smile on our face? And so you're delivering some pretty nasty information for people who have got these addictions to sugar and whatever else, but you're doing it with humor. And that was one of the key things I wanted us to try and dive into. And it's actually pretty revealing to hear what you're talking about, because it sounds like it just has come from such a real place for you. But I remember you showing us the video that you did for your friend where you got all the different people involved.
That was before that. Yeah, that was yes, it was actually a 10-year anniversary of it yesterday, and they posted online again, and I was watching it just in disbelief because it was 10 years ago. But yeah, basically got about 65 of our friends. It was a best man speech for one of my mates, and he asked me to do the speech, but instead we shot this secret video. He's a big fan of like 80s bad music, and so I wrote this 80s rap and had it choreographed, and we got all of our friends and we shot it, and like a full production number, and they didn't know about it. And then we set up a screen on the night of their wedding, and then as I got up and spoke, I just said turn around, and we played it, and it was just one of those extraordinary moments where I often watch their reaction to it if I'm feeling a bit down, because just to see the joy and the love and the shock that all their friends had somehow put this together because they love and care for them so much, but also did it behind their backs, is again, was that, like I said before, it was again another moment for me of seeing how powerful film can be in terms of bringing joy and getting people into their hearts and getting them open and excited, and magic of that, and doing it as a shared group. I just love that. Like, I, you know, so much of our film watching now, as we know, is kind of with a loved one or on our own on a laptop and stuff. And I really bemoan that. And we when we came to release Sugar Film and 2040, we were really adamant that I wanted it to be a community event, and we would do a tour of the country, and we'd get experts on stage, and we'd make it a town hall meeting and watch the film, and then have parents stand up and ask questions, or have kids in the audience, and like have community. That's what cinema used to be. People used to go and watch the news together every night at 6 o'clock in the cinema and share and guffaw and screech, and like we've lost that. And I think cinema has an opportunity to be that again. And again, I worry because we're sort of getting into the superhero mode, and it's all very monoculture, and it's just sort of, you know, it's not that shared experience. And I think cinema can be that. So I'm certainly doing my best to try and make films that evoke that and bring joy and wonder and the shared experience that is ripe for conversation.
Yeah.
I remember reading a great Oscar Wilde quote before Sugar, and he said that if you want to tell people the truth, you got to make them laugh or they'll kill you. I also think we've got, you know, all the psychology now says that we have this thing called a window of tolerance, and there's only so much that we can take before we disengage and switch off. And, you know, these kind of inconvenient truth, or these kind of, like you said before, opening the wound, these types of films are really powerful probably in the late 90s, early 2000s, because we weren't saturated with them, and our media wasn't saturated with negative stories. So we've got to be careful, I think, how we tell our stories. You can still show the problem, but I think we should be framing it in a solutions narrative so that you're only spending a small amount of time on the problem and then showing the solutions. Whereas I think the traditional model for docos has been 89 minutes of how bad things are with a couple of minutes on the end to say, hey, buy this kind of tuna or eat like this. And I just think we've got to flip that.
Yeah. Well, and you certainly have. I reckon we'll see a range of 2040 style pieces coming out because of the reaction to it, you know. And I know in our world, in surfing and Patagonia circles, it's been so inspiring for a lot of people to be able to zoom in on those specific solutions. And one of the reasons, again, why I wanted to have this chat with you today was about an update, you know, because I know every time we get to catch up, I'm in your ear about the whole marine permaculture and seaweed story of how we can clean up the mess we've been making along coastlines. And yeah, I just wanted to see if you had any updates for us so that we can share this with people as soon as possible around the seaweed, carbonate, regen ag, whatever you feel is most inspiring.
Yeah, in a lot of ways, 2040 was an experiment. It was an experiment in kind of climate psychology of using those solutions to motivate people. And I remember there's this brilliant quote that stuck with me, Raymond Williams, really early on. He said that to be truly radical is to make hope possible rather than despair convincing. And I thought, okay, well, let's see if you can use hope as a motivation. Like, it's all well and good to feel very good after you've seen the cinema and you go, wow, but does that translate into action? So we did, for those that don't know, set up this sort of action impact campaign off the back of the film, where we teamed up with about 50 different organisations, that gave people a direct entry point after they'd seen the film and felt that sort of emotion. How could they connect and get involved with something they resonated with in the film? And one of those, for example, was this marine permaculture, which is the seaweed platform that this American scientist had come up with. So we put out this sort of crowdfunder. We teamed up with Intrepid Travel, and they agreed to match fund any dollar we raised. And just, you know, in the blink of an eye, in about 3 months, we raised almost $700,000 to build that platform just from people giving $15, $20 donations. I'd have kids giving $5 of their lunch money at school screenings, like, because people just felt like, right, I want to see that happen and I want to contribute to it. So just from that happening, we're now building it in Tassie in Storm Bay and working with the University of Tasmania and some other groups down there. And the seaweed's in the water and we're testing it in different temperatures, and there's a full laboratory set up, and it's all happening because of people caring and having an outlet to contribute in some way instead of feeling paralyzed and hopeless by a film that might have showed them how bad the oceans are. What do you do about that? This actually creates that action point. So that's been probably, you know, the most exciting for me. The other way and I get excited was is we developed about 31 free lesson plans for teachers in the Australian curriculum, because so many teachers would say to us the kids are desperate for solutions. They're sick of hearing how much plastic's in the ocean or how dead the fish are. They want to know the solutions. And so we've had about 21,000 teachers download that, which equates to almost 950,000 students in Australia have seen and been taught the curriculum materials, which is just like, that to me makes me feel so happy in terms of giving that generation. And, you know, we regularly get sent things from kids that where they've built their own little miniature microgrid setup, or someone, I spoke to a student yesterday who's doing a project on seaweed and she's developing this plastic out of it and stuff just from seeing the film. So this is what ideas can do. This is what solutions can do for humans. They bring out this beautiful part of us. And then there's one with the Regen Ag. So they've that's a setup where you can give, the public can give $8 a month, and that money pays farmers to put carbon back into their soils. And they've had almost 500 farmers sign up to that. They're almost up to $100,000 in terms of that money just from people making that donation. But they're also now getting interest from government bodies and different organisations that, as you know, this sort of regenerative agriculture soil carbon story is really growing in very quickly right around the world. So that's exciting. And yeah, and then there's other things. People can mentor girls online. We've had lots of people do weekly mentorships to educate girls around the world. They've also given money there. There was a microgrid set up that we did an equity crowdfund. So not only do you donate, but you actually get a stake in the company, and raised almost $1 million for that company. That's an Australian group here. And now we've just launched a video around a similar model of decentralizing food, so that there's an app that actually connects you to everyone growing food in your area, so that you, if you're growing basil, you might meet with someone who's growing carrots, and you can do an exchange of food in your area. Again, to create that community resilience, especially right now. I mean, I think everyone's realizing there's a panic buy on seeds as well, which is just a great thing, I reckon. You know, if you're going to panic buy anything, let it be seeds. But how do we actually move forward, share our food in a different way? So we're not just got this duopoly in Australia of just these two supermarkets that are really screwing over the farmers in a lot of ways. There's huge amounts of waste, supply chain problems, huge energy to get the food around the country. Let's just start localising, and we've got the technology to do it now. So, yeah, there's so many things going on, and every week we probably get three or four people approach us with different ideas that we sort of try and vet, and some of them we work with and try and get it out there. But, yeah, it's been really a joy to just to see it spread and people run with it, and people putting on their own regeneration weekends, and right around the world, bands contacting us to use the visuals on their backdrop, even like U2, like to use some of the visuals, or French Environment Minister reaches out to have fun. Like, it's just been crazy, the sort of the tendrils that the film has reached. And as you said, I think it's because there hasn't been, for some reason, anything out there that's showing solutions. And as you said, people are really ready for it. So I feel very proud of it. And like I said, but the work has only begun, as you well know.
Yeah. The last one that you were just mentioning about, you know, food hubs and awareness of who's growing what in an area, are you able to mention that at all, or is that about to release and become interactive for people?
Yeah, that's now live. So we released it a few days ago, and it's on our websites and on our social media channels. And it's been really great, the response they've had, especially from farmers. So, you know, it's because farmers are really copping it here. This is just a great way for them to have a secondary income, grow organic food, and then share it with other people. And also, we got an email from someone in the UN from Sudan actually yesterday, who wants to use the tunnels in the communities over in Sudan. So, yeah, it's just, you know, just you just lob these things out there and see what happens. And I think that the time is right for them now, which is really exciting.
Do you think I would qualify if I went for a walk in my neighbour's paddock in Psychedelic Valley and got a bunch of gold tops? Would I be able to enter that into the app and trade? Does it work like that?
I think that they are essential for the network, especially in these trying times. Yeah. That yeah, we thought about getting the Flow Hive honey on there, the eggs, anyone who bakes bread, but I think there should be a special secret button for the golden tops.
Yeah, 100%. Well, hey, I wanted to read to you a couple of things that I just also read from Tim Flannery, and I just thought it was interesting, and I wanted to, you know, hear your thoughts on this. His quote here was saying, in his words, "There is a birth of a global consciousness right now, and it's just axiomatic and that the most dangerous time in the life of any entity is its moment of birth. Where it's most vulnerable, it's most weak, it's most disorganized and helpless. We started off that way as human beings, so it is a moment of great danger, but a moment of necessary opportunity and growth in a trajectory." And when I was reading that, I was just thinking about this point in time, and this is even pre-virus stuff, and just feeling like he is right on the money. How do you feel about a statement like that?
It's spectacular and it's true, and it reminds me of two things. One is a similar quote by a guy named William Davies, who said that to experience a crisis is to inhabit a world that is temporarily up for grabs.
Wow.
Yes, this embryonic element, or that, again, that metaphor of the caterpillar going into the chrysalis, and as it goes into the chrysalis, it actually loses it, all its definition. It turns into this goo, amorphous, nondescript substance, and somehow it reshapes itself. Scientists still don't know how, into this butterfly. And I feel like in many ways that's where we are. We're in this, there's a liquidity of not quite knowing what we are right now. Do we go back, or do we actually do things very differently? And that it is a very delicate moment, because the decisions we make in the next 6 months or a year will determine the next 10, 20, 30, 40. We know that, especially environmentally, but now even socially, with all this debt that governments are going to go into, all these bailouts. What does that mean for the generations ahead of us? That, are they going to be paying that off? Like, all the decisions we're making now are so crucial. And when you marry that up with, which I think is one of the biggest issues of our time, is that our information environment is just as polluted as our ecological environment.
Yeah.
That how do we make the right decision properly? How do we collectively make sense of anything right now? When, as we're seeing, even with the virus, the amount of information that's flying around, and everyone's got their statement and they're appealing to their tribes and they're having contrarian views on what's going on. Like, it's just a mess. And there's a great British historian, Sir John Glubb, and he talked about that before any civilization started to unravel, it lost a sense of shared value and shared truth. And he studied civilization collapses. And I feel like Tim's so right there, that this is a delicate embryonic phase, and I do have concerns about how we're relating to each other and making decisions, that in this particular time where we've got to cradle this little thing and nurture it and make sure it makes it through, do we have the right tools to do that as a collective? I'm not sure. But I feel like it's why anyone that has an inkling of this stuff should be shouting up on the rooftops right now and contributing online in a way that's very carefully managed. That is our collective consciousness. That is our collective brain. What are you putting into it? Are you sharing fear? Have you actually done the deep research on what you're sharing? Do you know that it's true? Or are you just adding pollution? Are you throwing more plastic into the ocean? And I think all of us have to really consider that right now, and yeah, more than ever. What we're trying to do with 2040 is at least set ourselves up as some kind of trusted space that, if you come to us, we have done the research, we've consulted, we've reached out to differing views on certain topics to get us a consensus. But ultimately, I think too, it's about your own experience. And that's why I made the sugar film, was to go, there's so many conflicting stories out there. What is my experience of it? When I ate the sugar and did the experiment, that's all I can speak from. And maybe it's other people will resonate with that, but this is what happened to me. And the same with 2040. there was so much information about climate change and stuff out there. Like, I've got to go to Bangladesh and I've got to see what's happening and how impacted they are. I've got to go to Tanzania. I've got to go and meet these Aussie farmers and talk to them about rainfall patterns and what. And the minute you have that experience, for me, I think it just grounds it. I was like, okay, I get this now. It takes it out of that intellectualizing, academic, online, social media, YouTube space, and you actually can sit in something. It becomes the truth because you've experienced it, or you're talking directly to people that have lived it. Mm. And I think that's a very different space. And I hope more people do that, because that's, I think, what's going to get us through this time, is we need people to show their integrity and to be ruthless in their sense-making and their truth, and to be very careful about what they're sharing and putting out there, and to not put it out there. It's okay if you don't share it. You know, like, do your own vetting, because it matters. All those shares, it is like a virus, and it can spread around this planet and infect, you know, and it's a great metaphor for what's happening. So let's social distance our shares as well, and be very careful about what we actually contribute.
Mm. You were saying the other day just about, like, you know, herd mentality and tribalism, and I was just curious to perhaps dive into that a little bit more, because it feels like there's this bizarre contrast right now of, like, us right now. We were probably going to be hanging out with the kids and playing and getting feral among the, you know, the bush and hanging out here. But, you know, things have changed and there's a bit of space now between us, and I'm on a computer and you're on a computer, probably when we'd prefer to be outside. But there is this bizarre opening where, even though we are in our little cubicles, we're in our home spaces, there is a reaching out that's happening. Like, I know I'm personally reaching out to my friends overseas more than ever, because I'm really concerned about them and wanting to hear from them and just see if they're okay. And I was just curious to hear your thoughts about that, about how we can perhaps be moving away from that herd mentality of just taking information that comes and just having it validate our own bizarre points of view. You can find anything online to back up whatever you're thinking in your head. Have you got any insights into that?
Yeah, I mean, I've thought a lot about, you know, because it's actually very interesting psychology. There's a host of reasons why people do that. And I'll preface it by saying that I've been in that space. Like, I reckon 10 years ago, I really went down some rabbit holes around some alternative thinking and ideas, and even some of the books behind me are, you know, what most people go, why did you read that? But again, it was about trying to explore everything and understand it. And what I would say is that I often have a real respect for, even, you know, people that might be into conspiracy theories and whatnot, because at some level they're saying, the world should be better than what it is. Mm. I dream of a better world. Mm. I'm choosing to say that something is blocking that, whether it's an Illuminati or some kind of conspiracy, but it's actually revealing this yearning for things to be better. And I can relate to that. My particular pursuit on that is saying, well, it's probably this system we've got in the corporate structure and these vested interests in the fossil fuels, and they are controlling the narrative. And so I've got my version of a conspiracy theory, but I can relate to those other people. So try to find those bits where we unite. And especially in this moment, as you said, if anything's revealing how much we do care about each other, it's the fact that we are adhering to social distancing. The skies are silent. The shops are closed. The streets are empty. That's because we give a shit about each other. And we should remind ourselves of that in this time, that we look at what we're doing collectively. It's extraordinary that we've just suddenly changed the rules of the game in a month. And it's because we give a shit.
Mm.
So, but when it comes to online, I think there's people coming at it from really different attributes. So there are people that are naturally contrarian. So the minute that an authority says something, they'll take a default position on that. Mm. That's just kind of what they do. Then there's the group that I do the social cues to their own group or their followers. They need to sort of, well, this is in my wheelhouse, so I've got to share that. It might be a political thing. It might be a lack of trust in science. Whatever it is, everyone's coming at it from their own psychology. And I think we forget that sometimes. We dehumanize online. And I just try, you know, if I'm reading this stuff, I go, right, where's this person coming from? Or why are they saying this? They deeply care and they're passionate about this to share, and try and find the human there. And that's really challenging sometimes, especially when they attack me or they'll have a go about something to me, or climate deniers, or especially the sugar stuff, just so much, you know, but you go, okay. And the minute you sort of de-escalate it, and I'd say, oh man, it's an interesting view. If you hear about it, and try and talk them off the ledge, nearly every time you'd end up in that conversation reaching some kind of peaceful thing and saying, hey, thanks for the chat, mate, great. Like, but we don't meet each other there. We often throw a barb back with another barb and the whole thing just falls apart.
Mm.
So how can we find that moment, especially online, to hold that space, see beyond the reactive type that they've done and actually humanize and actually end up having a really interesting conversation or learn something that you didn't learn before. So taking that assumption with every interaction that maybe there's something for me to learn here from this interaction, I think would fundamentally change our entire system. But it's one of our biggest challenges.
It is a serious challenge. And much like you, when you were saying that you were wanting to show the films in community halls and make them these community gathering events, we've been doing similar stuff with Patagonia with some of our issue-based surf films like Nevertown, some other projects we've been doing where we make sure we have these community events, because when you're sitting in the space together and hanging out and you're actually having small talk with each other and the farmers are hanging out with the fishers and the fishers are hanging out with the surfers and there are all these cross-pollination happening and you're all there perhaps having a beer or a cup of tea, you do stay human. And that was something that I was just thinking about with this moment right now, given that we can't really do that. And I wonder how long this is going to be in place. So will there be some type of humanizing of the internet? Is it going to happen somehow? Mm. Is there any signs of that you've been able to see?
There's certainly interesting examples where there's really interesting stories of like this when the public transport shut down in China, that this group of drivers set up their own community fleet app where they would just pick up doctors and nurses and take them from home to the hospital. So they use the internet for that. There's this young boy in America who set up this sort of virtual play date for kids in different countries so they can all come online and meet another 8 or 10-year-old from a different country and have a chat about a culture. So there's lots of those little examples, which I just think are beautiful. But I think we have to understand that even the setup and structures of our media platforms, whether it's Facebook's, the Instagrams or Twitter, they are also part of the system like any other corporation that relies on exponential growth, pleasing their shareholders, that they have to create more revenue. And the way they create more revenue is to promote more inflammatory headlines and tools and give more credence to sort of extremist views, because they get the likes and the shares, and the more likes and shares they get, the more ad revenue they're generating, and so they can build up their market. So it's trapped in this horrible system, and I'd say that goes across the board, whether it's any kind of company or a social media company. That is the problem with our system, and that we've come up against the boundary now where we're smashing ecological boundaries and climate change and ocean acidification and deforestation. That is all the result of this exponential growth machine that keeps going and going. So unless we address that, we're not going to fix any of this. And that goes for social media in the same way that it goes for an oil company. So there are people experimenting with new social media ideas. There's a group that I've been working with. There's another one, Wikipedia, just put out their own version where all that sort of data element's gone to it. It's still got algorithms that sort of want to hook you and you want to engage and share things, but it's very early and not yet there. But I think we're starting to have the technology, the blockchain stuff that's coming through, that these things will emerge in the years ahead. We're seeing Ecosia is a great example of the search engine that allows you to plant trees. They take that ad revenue that Google takes and makes billions. They take that ad revenue at Ecosia and they give it to organizations to plant trees. And they've planted almost 100 million trees around the world now just from people searching online.
Mm.
So we're going to see more benefits or social good elements of technology coming through.
These things that are localizing people's efforts. You know, like when I've spoken to people in Tasmania and we talk about the fact that 90-odd% of the seaweed around those coastlines was stripped from heat waves in the ocean there a few years ago, but there is this way forward with an approach like the vertical kelp forests. The look in people's eyes when they realize there's something close in their neighborhood with their understanding and their investment and their embedded nature in their region is just awesome, isn't it? It's like, and you've come across this so much in all the fields that you're in, and that's just such a feeling of hope.
Yeah, mate, there's a great story with the Seaweed Project as well in Tassie where on the North Bruny Island, there's an Aboriginal corporation that own a big patch of the North Island there. And they said they used to have all this kelp growing in their private bay they've got there. So they actually reached out to us and said, can you, we want to regrow the kelp in this area. Now that you've found this, you know, it's this super kelp species that can grow in the warmer waters. So the team started drilling these holes into the ground there to replant the kelp there that can survive in those waters. And they're calling it caring for sea country.
Wow.
Because there is a tradition of using kelp in certain ways, not just for food, but in ceremonies. And just to see that response now that they thought that was gone, but now they get to regenerate it in their own bay. It's like, this is it. And as we talked about before, you see people light up. It's like, this is what gets us up every morning. Yeah. The idea of the hope, the possibility of a better future is what motivates us. Mm. And yet for some reason, all our messaging has been about how bad things are. And we've just got to turn that around because that has the opposite effect. It paralyzes us. And you get it. And I just hope you're right that we start to think really carefully about how we tell our stories moving forward.
This episode of Watershed Chats is presented by Patagonia, whose purpose-driven mission is to use business to protect our home planet. Thanks to our sound engineer, Shannon Sol Carroll. On behalf of myself, Lauren Hill, and my partner in rhyme, Dave Rastovich, thanks for listening with us. Learn more at waterpeoplepodcast.com.